The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Heidi ho, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his physiotherapist, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 50 of The Big Picture for the week beginning March 13. And coming up on today's show, relax, put your feet up, just don't go outside because we're visiting 10 Cloverfield Lane.
But if you do go outside, watch out for those crooked cops in 999.
And of course, stay tuned for the present we give ourselves because The Big Picture is turning 50.
That's right, Mark. We're up to episode 50. Can you believe it, my friend?
Let me show you my walking frame. Yes.
No, we have aged gracefully, though.
We have.
Dignified. I mean, I'm looking good for 50.
I'm a silver fox.
I'll speak for myself. Okay. I don't even have hair. But if I did, I'm sure I'd be a silver fox. Yeah, episode 50.
50.
Wow.
What mate. The heck?
There'll be plenty more 50 references throughout the rest of the show.
I'm just starting to wonder why people have actually hung in there. But please, go on.
I'm glad we did. But before we get to the rest of the show, let's kick off with some news that's happening around the traps this week. At cinemas this week, Mark, there are two new Australian productions at cinemas in smaller release. I think if you go around your art house cinemas nearby your place, you might find The Will to Fly or Spear. The Will to Fly is a sport documentary about Lydia Lasilla, who is a ski jumper, world famous ski jumper. And Spear is the Bangara Dance Company's first feature film. They're around the place at the moment if you want to go check them out.
All right. Okay. And on TV tomorrow night, Monday, March 14, there's a doco on the ABC you might want to check out. One of those hidden tragedies of teen life, My Self-Harm Nightmare, starts at 9:30 p.m. It's a film that kind of highlights the soaring rates of eating disorders and self-harm among young people, and it explores where they basically talk about it on the internet. And so where they go to share their problems is something that parents should probably be aware of. If you have a teenager, I'd recommend this documentary.
On Blu-ray and DVD and that kind of thing, the latest Bond film, Spectre, is out. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and check out Mark's review, which is handily packaged in a video format just for you.
There you go. And here's something I won't recommend, but it's on anyway. Maybe so you can tune in elsewhere.
Tune out.
Yes. Tuesday, March 15, Seven Upgrades Wife Swap. You might remember that one. For the 21st century Australian version of the US show that shocked a nation, The 7 Year Switch, which is basically, I know, according to studies or old wives' tales, you can read which, around 7 years, couples start wondering whether they really should have chosen somebody else. So Sevens decide to help out by taking four couples in crisis and sending them to live in a marriage experiment with somebody else. Yes, doing the bedroom part as well. Okay, we've now televised sex. So Seven's switch therapy might be what's needed to save their relationships. I say their new title should be The Home Wrecker Network.
Wow.
We'll be reviewing that in a later program. Yeah.
My morality meter is going off the charts. In some news around the film world this week, Mark, on the 21st of July, a little movie you might like to call Star Trek Beyond.
Whoa!
Is coming out. That's right. Sorry. The latest in the Star Trek franchise. And what I think will also get your heart racing, Mark, is that it's directed by Justin Lin, who is famous for the Fast and the Furious franchise, which I know you also love. So in entertainment news this week, two franchises that are close to your heart, Star Trek and Fast and Furious, finally come together on the 21st of July. You're welcome.
You've lifted me up and then dropped me in a pit at the same
I found it the most amusing thing I've heard all week.
Okay.
Please, what have you got to tell us?
Well, George Martin has died. Yes, laugh that one off.
Oh.
Okay, the record producer of the Beatles died peacefully in his home at the age of 90. Now, look, we thought it's worth noting George Martin's passing because George Martin was often referred to as the fifth Beatle. He was the manager come producer of the Beatles. He produced more than 700 of their records and was behind 23 number one singles for the English rock band in the US and 30 in the UK. The news of his death was first revealed by Beatles drummer Ringo Starr. Amazing passing of one of those people behind the scenes that make that band so big.
Now, Mark, before we get to our What Your Kids Are Watching choice for this week, I have a true or false challenge for you, as we do on the show. Because it's our episode 50, I've chosen some trivia from 51st Dates, that film from 2004 starring Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. I know you're a massive fan of Adam Sandler's career.
This is our 50th date.
Yeah, this is our 50th date together. So, in a scene in that film, there's a dentist and a woman in the dentist's chair. And the woman playing the dentist is Jackie Sandler, who's Adam Sandler's wife, who's actually a dentist in real life. And the woman in the chair is played by Linda Siegel, who's the wife of the director, Peter Siegel. Is that true?
Wow. Adam Sandler is married to a dentist. Why didn't they wire his mouth shut sooner? Okay, let's come back to that.
We'll come back to that after what your kids are watching. What did we choose this week?
Well, this week we've actually been looking at, well, gosh, something you possibly don't want to look at. Ali G, Borat, Bruno, The Dictator. Sacha Baron Cohen is one of the best known shock comedians in the world. And his latest movie, Grimsby, is what your kids are watching for our choice for this week. Because of what your teens are likely to be sniffing out, not necessarily what we'd be encouraging them to have a look at. Ben saw Grimsby. Yes, we put a gun to his head and forced him into the cinema and got more or less what he expected, especially when it comes to the shallow attempts at making us care about loyalty and family values.
Look, Seb, that's the couple that's adopting us.
You are coming with me, right, Nobby?
I'd never leave my little brother.
We've decided to adopt one of the brothers, Mr. Loseley.
But these boys are inseparable. It would break their hearts.
Sir, are you sure about sending Agent Graves?
He's the best I ever trained.
For 28 years, I've been searching for my baby brother.
That's right. For 28 years, I've been searching for my baby brother. This character, Nobby Grimsby, played by Sacha Baron Cohen. And he discovers his brother, his estranged brother, is in the shape of an actor called Mark Strong. And he's in the shape of a James Bond, Jason Bourne type secret agent. And so Grimsby, in short, is like a lager lout mixed in with a spy movie film. Ta-da. That's what Grimsby is, Mark. That's it. That's what you get.
So you basically just got this collision of Liverpudlian type
Essex, I believe.
Essex, is the
area of England that's being lampooned in this movie,
you know,
Mark.
Which clash of cultures, city mouse, country mouse, but done at a vulgar level.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Yes, in short, yes. And Sacha Baron Cohen's done this before. Like Ali G was making fun of this kind of person in this working class, big family, married young, if they're married at all. All they do is drink and support England in football, that kind of stereotype. He's done that with Ali G 15, 20 years ago. Now he's back for more.
Yeah, and this is sort of classic duck out of water stuff for Baron Cohen, isn't it? He's best known for these sort of controversial mockumentaries.
That's what he's best known for, but this isn't one of those mockumentaries.
No,
it's just treated more seriously. I think what happened is Sacha Baron Cohen wanted to make an action movie, and so he's got enough power to be able to do that. And so he went into the right kind of meetings, and they said, can we do this? And they go, all right, let's do it. And here it is. That's it. That seems to be the only reason that this film exists.
So can he stop himself from going into that other sort of favourite territory of him, basically diving into offensive material?
No, he cannot. No. So I wasn't a big fan of Grimsby. And I should say, for full disclosure, I really like some of what Sacha Baron Cohen does. Admittedly, very offensive and shocking stuff. And I often have to check my own sense of humour about when I watch his stuff. But Borat, for all the ickiness of it that you can find, I did find the guy can be unusually funny throughout that.
Yeah, occasionally.
He's an incredible comic performer.
Yeah, he can be quite insight in the things he chooses to laugh at, but almost always he goes over the meter with me. Like, you know, you just get to that point where the first 5 minutes is fine, the next 10 minutes you're uncomfortable, and 10 minutes after that you're going, what the heck?
Yeah, and Grimsby, as much as the jokes are flat, often very old, dated, and there aren't that many of them, particularly one-liners that come up, when you get to the offensive material in Grimsby, which is going to happen because it's a Sacha Baron Cohen film, it's just in there to shock you. Like, I think at other times in Borat, a good example, he may have had other deeper intentions, or it may have even been clever, even if it was smutty and just like outright like make you want to like run out of the cinema and vomit. But it could have actually been creative. Now, there is creativity in Grimsby, but that's about as far as I go. There's a couple of scenes in this that I won't break your delicate ears, Mark, by describing what's in this. But my goodness, it just felt tired and lame and trotted out. And he got to this point in the script and like, well, what are we going to do as we're running around the world trying to save the world from some outbreak of a virus? And I won't go into details, but it's really not worth seeing. And the fact that he keeps hammering this joke just shows how desperate I think Sacha Baron Cohen's become. Or lazy, as the case may be. That's right. I don't really have much good to say about Grimsby.
Okay, so you might not have picked this up from Ben's, you know, fairly subtle review, but this is not, you know, if your kids are thinking of going and seeing this film, this is not going to do them any good. Are we clear on this?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know if you expect any good to come from this kind of movie anyway.
What about the family values? There seems to be this sort of family value theme going through the storyline. You know, kids separate at birth, get back together, stand by your brother. Is that going to help? Or is that just going to be undermined?
It'd
by
be
the
nice
shock?
If it could, but yeah, it is undermined by the shock value. You're right. So as much as we've got loyalty, family values, and also standing up for quote unquote scum, the scum of the earth, people who are impoverished and seem a bit rough around the edges, but they're still people too. There's an endorsement of them throughout the film, but instead, what gets trampled as you go through it is any kind of, if your heart was going to go out to it, if you had any sort of empathy for what was going on with these people in the film, it's completely trampled on by the way they're presented. So I think Sacha Baron Cohen can do that to it as a disservice. So if there's anything deeper to take from this film, it gets absolutely smashed by the offensiveness and also the lameness that's going on around it.
Okay, well, Grimsby stars Sacha Baron Cohen, if you can call it that, Mark Strong, Isla Fisher, Rebel Wilson, of course. It's now showing at cinemas and is totally 100% correctly rated as MA15+.
Yes, sir.
For strong, crude sexual humour and nudity. Could have added strong action violence, to be honest. Beware, if we didn't make that very clear so far, be very, very aware.
Now, the true or false that I posed before, Mark, in 50 First Dates, there's a scene where there's a woman in a dentist chair and there's a dentist. The dentist is played by Jackie Sandler, Adam Sandler's wife, and she's actually a dentist in real life. And the woman in the chair is Linda Siegel, the wife of the director. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm going to say that directors, as I've known them, generally speaking, are so penny-pinching that if there was an actual dentist on the set, they'd probably get their wife's teeth done at the same time in order to actually manage things. So I'm going to go with true.
It's false, but your reasoning is very sound.
Thank you.
It's only false because the real dentist in this scenario is Linda Siegel, the wife of the director Peter Siegel, not Adam Sandler's wife.
Oh, okay.
So there was a real dentist there. She was just the one in the chair. That's true or false for this week. Now, coming up on the show, up next, wow, we've got a musical birthday present for us and for you, as well as a huge cast in a dodgy cops as robbers movie. It's brutal, but is it memorable?
Welcome back. You're at that segment of The Big Picture now where we're talking about soundtracks. We like soundtracks very much. We like to actually talk about the music that's often behind films, that sort of lifts films up. And this week's soundtrack is my gift to Ben as The Big Picture turns 50.
Oh, Mark, you shouldn't have. But you have, so thanks very much.
Yeah, you deserve every minute of this song I give you.
Okay.
It's a song written as part of a campaign to create a national American holiday, not to commemorate The Big Picture, but to commemorate the birthday of Martin Luther King. This song was actually written to promote the idea of having a holiday for Martin Luther King. The holiday composer proposed that it would facilitate the realization of Dr. King's dreams of integration, love, and unity for all God's children. And basically, if you haven't heard this song on a birthday occasion, you just haven't been listening. It's Stevie Wonder's Happy Birthday to You.
Could not have a day that would
So the interesting thing about this as far as soundtracks is concerned is that Happy Birthday has not appeared in a film. So you might very well be asking at this point, why is this appearing in a film show?
Why is this appearing in a film show?
Because the song that you might expect us to play during Happy Birthday is one we can't actually play.
Oh.
We cannot actually play Happy Birthday to You, the song.
Why?
Well, because we can't afford to, basically. And neither can Hollywood.
Even on our enormous budget that goes into episode 50 of The Big Picture.
Warner Chappell Music, who actually acquired the company that held the song's copyright for Happy Birthday in 1988, has been asserting its rights ever since, earning about $2 million a year on the use of Happy Birthday. Just the song.
Happy Birthday to them.
We would have to play it. We'd have to start paying if I started singing it. And so they get $2 million a year in royalties for performances. And that's why most films and TV shows don't actually use Happy Birthday as part of the show. In fact, what they do is they insert the copyright-free for He's a Jolly Good Fellow. I mean, the number of times you've actually seen a birthday take place on screen and they start singing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow, it's not because the rest of the world sings for He's a Jolly Good Fellow.
Or they even think he's a jolly good fellow.
Because it's free. And many programs and films have actually made spoofs all about this copyright fiasco, like Futurama and The Colbert Report and 30 Rock and Community have all done episodes that have almost led up to singing Happy Birthday and then have cut it out and made a big joke about the fact they have to cut it out because no one can afford it. You can't even sing it in Klingon. No kidding. Star Trek The Next Generation.
You would know that.
The seventh season of Star Trek The Next Generation tried to have Happy Birthday sung in Klingon and they couldn't afford it. Not even the Star Trek budget can afford Time Warner's rates. Happy Birthday to you, Ben, but I won't be singing it.
Our first now showing choice this week, Mark, is from the mind behind mind-bending storylines like Lost and Cloverfield, not to mention big-budget blockbusters like The Force Awakens and Star Trek. We're talking about J.J. Abrams, and the film we're talking about is 10 Cloverfield Lane. It's hit the big screens this week. It's about a young woman who wakes up in an underworld, underground, subterranean apartment and has to work out whether the man who's taking care of her is her savior or a monstrous kidnapper.
I'm going to keep you alive. You were in an accident, and I saved your life by bringing you here. And everyone outside of here is dead.
What happened to your arm? Were you trying to escape?
I was trying to get in.
What was that?
Quiet.
How do you know that this is real?
Creepy. You see, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, you might know her from Final Destination films, she plays Michelle and she wakes up in this underground cellar where most of the film takes place. She fears she's been abducted by this survivalist called Howard Stambler, who's played by John Goodman, which is a fantastic performance. And he tells her he saved her life and that a worldwide chemical attack has left the Earth's surface uninhabitable. But all she's got is his word for it. She's uncertain what to believe. She decides she's got to escape no matter what dangers she may face outside. And the distributors have told us not to tell anything after that. And it's true because...
Okay, well, we should stop the segment right now, Mark.
Good night.
Great review.
I've loved you being with this for ages.
Oh, please continue if you can.
Well, I'll tell you what I can say. It's basically a puzzle plot, a real true puzzle plot where the entire story arc hangs on a question. Will Michelle find out what's actually going on? You know, what's the truth? Is she underground for a good reason or not?
And how big a whack job is this guy?
I've got to say, the things we can say include that John Goodman is excellent in this film. He's just fantastic.
John Goodman is usually excellent in everything, but he's a great choice for this film.
The whole film hangs on his performance. Is he an eccentric survivalist or a grief-stricken dad or a mad as a March hare? You're not quite sure. You're always waiting for him to fall into one of those roles, and he draws the line neatly between all of them. The plot has more hairpin turns than the Macquarie Pass. That's one for our South Coast listeners. And more jumps than a BMX track. Well worth the price of admission.
Now, there's a big elephant in the room, though, isn't there? Is this a sequel to that big-budget monster movie from a couple of years ago, Cloverfield, that I talked about in the intro, that J.J. Abrams was behind? And actually, an interesting fact about Cloverfield, Mark, if you go and pick up the DVD or Blu-ray, on the cover, or at least on the back cover, you'll find a quote from me of the review I wrote for Empire magazine years ago.
And that is
self-promotion for this week.
And that's about the only reason I'd pick up Cloverfield, because it's such an awful film.
Mate, it was a 4-star film, according to Ben McKechnie from Empire magazine.
It was a short year.
How dare thee. Anyway, is it a sequel?
Look, no. And yes. No. Look, the reason why... Look, I think this entire film has been promoted on the back of J.J. Abrams produces. J.J. Abrams doesn't direct, J.J. Abrams doesn't write, J.J. Abrams produces, which basically means he got a bunch of people in a room and said, you guys should do this. Now, that's okay, because that's how production works. But even J.J. Abrams says this is not a sequel. This is the, as he describes it, the spiritual successor to Cloverfield.
But which is difficult to a sequel, how?
I think it's fair to reveal that the only connection between this film and the other one is that they both have Cloverfield in the title.
Oh,
okay, that's
good,
pretty much it.
Good revelation, okay, already revealed by the title.
And to quote J.J. Abrams, if you're anticipating a literal sequel, you'll be surprised.
And you mentioned before it's a bit twisty-turny, this thriller. What do you think? So what more can you reveal to us about the plot, or what goes on? What can you tell us about the experience of
from
Ten Cloverfield Lane?
From a scriptwriter's point of view, I can tell you this is a great script. This is fantastic because it does something that normally you only have happen to you once in a twist plot, and that is it convinces you that you know what's going on, then suddenly whips the carpet out underneath you. But this film actually convinces you that you know what's going on three times, I counted, and then changes it again. And in a way that is very believable. And you go, oh, of course, you're right. How could I have believed that before? You're right. Now I've got a grip on reality. So this is not a twist in the tail. This is a twist throughout. It's really quite clever.
And what about from a Christian perspective? We're all about that here at The Big Picture, a Christian perspective on movies, TV, and the like. What about from a Christian point of view? Much to take away from 10 Cloverfield Lane?
Not really, but there is one interesting thing. Now, this could apply to lots of films where people are trapped and worried and what are they going to do. The complete loneliness of the heroine in this situation, whatever Michelle was up against, whatever it be, whether it be disasters or crazies or monsters or monstrous fears or whatever is going on, which I'm not going to give away, she's doing the whole thing on her own. She has a little bit of support during the film, but generally speaking, it is all about what she is going to do. She had no one to appeal to but her fellow victims and those who threatened her. You know, and to me, that's the thing that I thought was the loneliest thing about the film. Because if I'd stuck a Christian in that situation, there's an inner resilience, an ability to stop and say, well, God, are you going to get me through this? How am I going to do this? Who am I going to reach out to? And that's not weakness. That's just basically relying on someone stronger than yourself. So all the way through this film, I'm thinking, gosh, I'd pray at this point. Or I would, you know, I would be relying on God at this point. Now, that's, of course, it's not a Christian film. So there's a lot of, you know, terror in it simply because there is no one to rely on. But here's an interesting fact. A while ago, I had to do a documentary on people who survive concentration camps.
Did you?
Yeah. You know,
this harrowing.
Yeah, the sort of fun stuff I do in my spare time. Oh. And one of the interesting things about the studies that were done for people who are actually kept in prisoner of war camps or concentration camps is the proportion of people who survive is demonstrably higher for those who actually have a strong spiritual faith about the life to come. You know, in these films, you always see with Cloverfield or other sort of films, the people who survive are those people who dig down deep and find something in themselves and go on. This is not true. In real life, it's people who look outside of themselves and have found a strength that will take them into eternity that are most likely to actually survive the worst that life can throw at them. And so in this case, I think this and many other films don't really give us reality. But then, you know, 15 minutes in the film, you realize they don't give us reality.
10 Cloverfield Lane gets big thumbs up from Mark. It stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead, John Goodman, John Gallagher Jr., and it's rated M for sustained threat, violence, and coarse language. Opened last Thursdays in cinemas all over the place. None underground as far as we know.
I'm pretty happy with that.
It's our 50th show, which means that before this show, Mark, we've done 49 other episodes. So go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and listen to all of them. That's our birthday present to you. We're more than happy to share those with you. Go and find them at thebigpicturewebsite.com. Do yourself a favor. Happy birthday. Listen to the past 49 episodes.
I so love our past work that when people come over for dinner or stuff like that, I say, let me get the iPad out. We'll just look at past episodes.
Even when I come over for dinner, that's what you do.
Well, it's because we're more interesting online than we are in life. Okay, look, speaking of things online, in the next edition of Eternity, Eternity is the Christian newspaper, Australia's only national Christian newspaper, fantastic publication, and they're great supporters of the show. And one of the things I thought you might want to see online, looking for some great Easter reads, they've actually put up, Eternity's actually rounded up a great list of Easter reading for your super long weekend. I mean, we're coming up to Easter, and if you're like many Christians, you want to focus in and to take this time to refresh yourself, in particularly looking at the center of our faith, resurrection, and reflect on the death and resurrection of Jesus, then you can actually go to this list and get some brilliant stuff to read up on. So it's online at the Bible Society's website, which is biblesociety.org.au /Eternity News, or just do what I do and basically Google Eternity Newspaper.
Still to come on the show, Bill Collins, the sequel, and also my top five presents, because I got you five, Mark. Top five presents from me to you.
Can't wait. Welcome back, Mark and Ben with The Big Picture again.
Episode 50, Mark. Happy birthday to us and to everybody for listening.
The weight of posterity on my shoulders. What we have given to humanity. I'll be accepting my humanitarian award
later.
So
distinguished. We're up to the press record choice for this week. And now last week, we were having an epic week in episode 49, chatting about past and present epic films and speaking to an epic film reviewer, Mr. Movies himself, Bill Collins. Well, there was too much gold in that interview that Mark did with Bill to just leave it lying around the cutting room floor. So this week, contemplating our own grand old age, we go back to Bill to ask him how kind time has been to filmmaking and the golden years of Hollywood.
Well, when we talk about those golden years, I guess we were really talking about the triumph of the studio system, you know, vertical integration of everything from production to theatre distribution with actors and directors and writers under long-term contracts. But did that make for better movies?
Recently, I was checking up on a film that I'm presenting very soon on my program on Foxtel, and it's called Captain Blood. Captain Blood was not the movie debut of Errol Flynn, but it was the film that the first good one he was in, and it made his name, that lasted for years. And my wife and I, previewing this, were saying, oh my goodness, this is just amazing. There's magic in this, there's potency, there's presence. Everybody, even the supporting actors, made you care about them and what they have to say and what they do. But these days, one doesn't have that in movies anymore. I remember recently, I don't just see new ones, I see a lot of the films of yesteryear, and they just seem to have more for me. There's more oomph in them, but there's a thought that you're transported into another world.
Some of the great classics from this period, like The Greatest Story Ever Told or The Ten Commandments, actually worked hard to do more than just tell a story, but to tell us something about life, I guess to teach us. Do you see films doing much of that these days?
No, I think they're time killers. A little story. Alexander Korda was quite a filmmaker in England, and Emlyn Williams, an actor, said he had an idea for a film, and he talked to Alexander Korda because he hoped Alexander Korda would produce it and finance it. And Korda said to him, well, I don't think this film is going to make much money, but I think it's going to be a good one. We'll do it.
Right, so it was actually more important what the film was going to pass on to the audience than the bottom line.
It was worth doing. And one gets that feeling with a lot of films of the 1930s and 40s that there was enthusiasm and thinking and people doing things and working together for the work itself, not just for one person to be the star to get all the money. But these days, I think money is a basic element in films more than it ever was in the 30s and 40s. It was always important. They wanted to make it, but I think they made it with more spirit, with more soul, with more love.
I guess there's lots to be said about film that we'd like to see that might be done better, but when do you still see the glimmers of gold re-emerging in modern Hollywood?
Mark, I don't know if I can answer your question. I find the situation today rather confusing. I don't think the films have the loyalty and the love that they used to have. I think some years ago, people loved films because they transported them into another world and then they could get on with their business and their lives as well. But they always had the goals that, oh, we will go to the movies and see something which we will love and enjoy. And these days, it's not like that at all. Yeah, I think it's a lot to do with the world itself. There are so many things of course, the pain or grief, and I think, oh, what a shame. Yeah, I'll tell you something. I was talking to a lady one day in the supermarket, and she came up to me and said, "Oh, I love the films of the golden years of Hollywood, Bill, that you're putting on television." And she was a viewer of my work on Foxtel. She said, I love the movies you do. And I said, "How did you feel about the movie on Saturday night, which was like two nights away? How did you feel about that?" She said, "Oh, I didn't see that." I said, "In previewing it, it's a great picture and I was so thrilled to put it on. Why didn't you see it?" And her answer is a typical answer when you think about it. She said to me, "I hadn't seen it before and I didn't know whether I'd like it or not." She was serious. And my reply, of course, was not very gentlemanly. But that's what people are like. They haven't seen it before. They haven't been told it's good. And so they don't want to see it.
And so they don't know what they're missing. I've got to say, there's a lot to say for what Bill brings up in that interview. The fact that, you know, we are too safe in our viewing. You know, sometimes we lock ourselves out, and I include the Christian community. We've got to be a bit careful with this. We lock ourselves out of other experiences, other ways of seeing life, and then sometimes miss the great glory that God is actually achieving in various areas because we say, "Well, you know, I don't know about it, so I guess I just won't go see it."
But if you wanted to continue to be safe and not sorry, don't worry about seeing Grimsby.
Don't see Grimsby. That's not a part of your life you have to worry about.
Don't use that as a massive challenge to your Christian faith.
Well, look, let's talk about something that might actually be worth seeing. Since cinema was a lad, cops and criminals have combined to create one of the most frequent screen genres. And our second now showing choice for this week is Triple Nine, a star-studded crime thriller where the cops are the criminals. So what side of law enforcement are we meant to be getting behind? Who knows?
"There's another job. She said she'd kill every last one of us. We don't get this thing."
"Poor man, crew. Who's that fourth guy?"
"We got a way to make this happen.
We could pull a 999.
"Triple nine? What is that?"
"That means the cop's been killed. Every cop in the city runs toward that call. We'd have all damn day."
"You all right?"
"I'm good. You?"
They're gonna kill him.
"Does anyone believe maybe something very big is about to go down?"
Mark, that's the voice of Woody Harrelson there, one of the many stars in this film. Everyone from Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad to Norman Reedus from The Walking Dead to Kate Winslet are in this film. From Australian director John Hillcoat.
Is she on a ship?
No, my friend. No, she's playing a Russian mob boss called Irina. She is the villain of the piece in Triple Nine. Well, one of the villains of the piece in Triple Nine. As your introduction suggests, Triple Nine is about cops, but pretty much all of them, apart from one, that's not giving too much away, the rest are dodgy. They're all dodgy. And the cops are played by guys like Norman Reedus from The Walking Dead. And what we get in this film is a kind of gritty, intense, but not terribly memorable cops and robbers movie about a bunch of cops that have worked out they can make a bit of money on the side by using their cop smarts to rob places or do over deals. But then, as you could expect, with a Russian mob boss being involved, things go bad, and the rest of the movie is then trying to make up for what happens when things go bad. And as you can imagine, things just go badder and badder.
Yeah, I've got to say, look, cop and crime movies are kind of like sliced bread and beer commercials. They're all pretty much the same. And what sets this one apart?
No, not too much, which is really disappointing. This is from Australian director John Hillcoat, and some of his films I've loved, The Road and The Proposition particularly.
The Road was great.
Just incredible, like, cinematic visions. Since then, not as great from John Hillcoat. Seems like every person in Hollywood would like to work with this guy, but like his last movie, Lawless, that starred Tom Hardy and Shia LaBeouf, really interesting subject matter, but expect more from it. And when you get into Triple Nine, like with Lawless, it doesn't really happen. So it's tight and gritty and pulsating at different times, but overall it felt like, to me, the problem for Triple Nine really is that in the last couple of years especially, we've had such great TV when it comes to crime. I'm thinking especially of like True Detective that Woody Harrelson was in, and The Wire. Anything that those shows had done across a variety of seasons, Triple Nine attempts to do. Now, if those shows didn't exist, maybe Triple Nine would be better. But because Triple Nine is coming in the wake of how good TV crime thrillers have become, it just feels lesser as you're going through it.
And shorter,
even though, and less character development, and less, why am I being involved with this? What is the purpose here? I struggled to find it.
Well, let's get to the story. Who are we meant to be barracking for in a film where everybody is bad?
Mate, that's the thing. Like, and not like you have to have an out-and-out good guy or good woman to follow. I think you can sometimes go along with an anti-hero. That's true. I think Deadpool kind of proved that for better or for worse. But like me trying to find the purpose of this film, I think it's hard to say exactly who it is I'm meant to be barracking for. Probably the closest you come is a character called Chris that Casey Affleck plays. He's like the incorruptible vein within a hugely corrupted heart. He's a little bit like, do you remember Al Pacino's film Serpico from the 70s? That was all about dodgy cops, and he was the one guy standing up against the system no matter what. Chris is like that, and he's a little bit of a breath of fresh air in this film. He's not necessarily a crusader. He's just the kind of guy who he's doing his job because that's what his job requires, and he's doing the right thing because that's what he's there to do. So that's a great thing. But 999 isn't necessarily asking us to get behind them. At the same time, it's not necessarily getting us to support the dodgy cops either. It's more like, here's a story that's unfolding about bad people doing bad stuff occasionally for good reasons. What's going to happen to them? That seems to be what we're meant to be getting behind, not one individual in particular.
Yeah, actually, as a Christian, I kind of start to look at things like this and start to wonder whether or not we're just being taught to hate law enforcement or just despise, you know, law enforcement.
Or mock or think that everyone's dodgy who has a badge or is in some position of authority. Yeah, again, I don't think 999 is trying to get this across. I'm still scratching my head. It can sound like that. I'm still scratching my head a little bit about why is this here and what are you attempting to show us beyond what we've already seen, which is sadly there can be a seedy underbelly to, excuse the pun, but there can be a seedy underbelly to law enforcement around the world. And 999 just seems to want to reinforce that there can be real nastiness and corruption in a place where that shouldn't be happening and where it should be standing up for us. But as a Christian, like, I don't think it's trying to tell me, you know, don't trust anymore. But I wonder, how can we go about upholding those who uphold the law? I wonder where we can go with admitting sin but not embracing it, which is kind of what happens in this movie, where these cops kind of, in these terrible situations that they're in, start hugging the sort of thing that they're meant to be pushing away. It raises more of that sort of thing and sort of questions like, should we go in and clean things up, not just accept them? So the one probably really positive thing I can get out of 999, as intense and visceral and quite challenging and gritty as this film can be at times, there are parts that are memorable. The biggest thing I take away from it is this character of Chris, Casey Affleck's character, this guy who at all costs don't just accept things, but you go in and do the right thing and don't be dodgy. I think as a Christian, that's a really powerful reminder to me of how I should how I should be going about, that's right, living my life in the world in every respect, not just whether I was a police officer or not.
Well, that sounds like the best thing to come out of the film, and you've got it now.
I finally found it.
Maybe we might as well leave that to the DVD rack. Look, 999 is now showing at cinemas and is rated MA 15+ for strong violence and coarse language. It stars stacks of cool actors, including Casey Affleck, Woody Harrelson, Aaron Paul, Norman Reedus, and Kate Winslet, but sans Titanic.
Yeah, but with a Russian accent. Yeah, fantastic cast. They're very watchable, but the movie not so much. What is going to be not so much watchable, Mark, as listenable, what's coming up on the show? The best movie made 50 years ago, as we keep going with this episode 50 theme. Happy birthday to us. And a special top 5 birthday present from me to you, Mark. I'm sure you've got... Actually, you've already got something for me.
I gave you a song.
Yeah, just a song.
Yep. Yeah, no, not one I had to pay for.
I've got 5 things for you coming up.
Welcome back, Ben and Mark here. As you may have heard, this is our 50th episode of The Big Picture.
It is, Mark? This 50. Is the 50th?
Oh, the weight of the years. Apart from, it's actually only been a year. Okay, and yet it feels...
Seems like 50.
Feels like 50. Apart from cutting popcorn cakes and buying each other new sets of 3D glasses, Ben and I thought a fine way to celebrate would be to celebrate something else that's turning 50. So we asked one of our regular reviewers, Insights editor Adrian Drake.
Is Adrian turning 50?
Adrian has done that at least a couple of times. Adrian is going to give us a special anniversary choice for this week's The Vault segment. What was the best movie released 50 years ago when I was a shy lad of 17, back in 1966?
I picked Fantastic Voyage.
Fantastic Voyage. Mate, okay.
And the reason for this
Tell us about that.
Well, the reason for this is, as a kid, I think probably when we first got our colour TV back in the day, it was one of the first science fiction films I think I ever saw.
Okay.
And it was made quite the impression, I think.
It did. Okay, now for anyone who hasn't seen Fantastic Voyage, I presume there are a lot of people out there that haven't, what's it about?
Well, it's a bit of a convoluted plot about, it's set in the Cold War, and it's about a scientist who is developing this technology to shrink people down to microscopic size for no apparent reason. Not sure why.
I thought it was going to win the Cold War by shrinking people.
No. Okay. And so he's involved in an assassination attempt and he gets injured. So they have to use his technology to shrink a team of scientists down with a vehicle to go inside his body to stop a blood clot going to his brain.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but was that not almost the exact same plot of a movie that was out in the 1980s that starred Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid and Martin Short called Inner Space?
That's correct.
It was remade as that. Now, why did this movie make such an impression on you?
I think it made such an impression on me primarily because it's full of amazing, well, at the time, amazing special effects.
From what I remember reading about that movie, it was quite a revolutionary piece of work on the special effects front.
Yeah, and like going through, they recreated all parts of the body and people being, you know, attacked by white blood clots.
High drama stuff.
But I think, I guess for me as a kid, it was one of the first times where I thought about how science fiction in films is kind of speculative, and it kind of led me to think, you know, we speculate about the future all the time, but I guess it formulated all my thinking about faith and film and how a film like this can sort of give an insight into the imagination of somebody else, but also give you some things to think about.
For the future, you mean?
For the future, yeah.
So you're not necessarily trying to say that from Fantastic Voyage you build up your Christian faith or anything like that.
Not at all.
But you mean more like it caused you to think about the future and what the future might be like.
And what that holds for me as a Christian.
From Fantastic Voyage.
Well, over the ensuing 20-odd years, I've had more thoughts about that.
Yeah.
And I think, too, it was just a very clever film at the time. And you always like the science fiction films these days. They're very flashy and there's lots of special effects, but they're, in the most part, speculative and they tell us about what we can expect in the future. But as Christians, we know to some degree our future is set in eternity. So, yeah, all very interesting stuff. But I'm not sure I got any of that from the film, but it helped me sort of develop my thinking around that.
But are you willing to say on record that everything from, say, Blade Runner to Interstellar have been influenced by Fantastic Voyage? Is that true?
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you, Adrian, for that special birthday present to us and to everybody out there looking back 50 years in cinema. If you want to look to the now, though, Mark, of cinema, you should head to insights.uca.org.au, the website that Adrian reviews on. Well, he's the editor of, so no, understandable that he reviews for it. And so, too, to regulars on the show, Russ Matthews and Toya Gaddis. They're great Christian reviewers looking at movies, new release at cinemas and DVD and all that kind of thing. They do that often, so head to insights.uca.org.au. to check it out.
Ben, we've come to the part of the program that I'm most excited about, where I get my gift.
I've made you wait for such a long time.
Oh, goody.
And here we finally are.
50 episodes and I finally benefit from this show.
Now, I thought about what could I give you, Mark, on this 50th edition of our show. No need to think.
Just write a check.
Mate, I put more thought into it and no, I'm not going to give you money.
Oh, wow.
So how could we celebrate? Now, you know there's a theme every year for a wedding anniversary?
Stick with me on this. Right.
I'm not trying to compare our...
You mean like the sort of things like paper and ruby?
Yes,
and,
exactly
stuff,
right. Yeah. Well, I ripped off the theme presents from the 10, the 20, the 30, the 40, and the 50-year wedding anniversary, and I used that as thematic choices and slotted them into the top five films that I give to you. So, mate, without any further ado...
I'm stunned and I'm ready to go. I can't believe it. You're actually going to make up for every other anniversary you missed. We do sound like a couple that didn't get on. Okay, great.
Five.
So, the 50th wedding anniversary present is gold.
Right.
So, I have got for you Aguirre, the Wrath of God, 1972 film made by Werner Herzog that stars Klaus Kinski.
Now, I do take it from this that I'm starting to get right from the outset, these are clearly gifts I don't own already.
Yes.
Films I've never seen.
I safely presumed you had not seen Aguirre, Wrath of God. And so while that title and the names of the people may freak you out and many other people out, I should point out from the start, yes, it's a German film, but it's a film set back in the 16th century.
That makes it much better.
Amazon, where Klaus Kinski is playing a Spanish soldier who is taking like a troop of soldiers in search of the legendary city of gold, El Dorado.
There's the gold reference.
There is the gold link. Why I think you should check this film out. It's an excellent, excellent film about the crazed search for gold. Obsession, greed is massive in this film. But also, there's an excellent portrait of religious warping, I think is probably the best way to put this. So this character, Aguirre, that Klaus Kinski plays, is a guy who's convinced that God has him placed where he has. He's given him this mission, like the Blues Brothers, I've given you this mission from God, you should go and do it. And so the film, I think, raises the kind of question for Christians and plenty of other people out there, what does God actually want you to do? And how do you actually know what God wants you to do? And particularly when it's coming to your, not just your own detriment, but to those around you, i.e. people are dying left, right, and center, and it's just madness and folly that's coming your way. Should you be pursuing what you want to pursue? This is a gift they give to you, Mark.
I just think, yeah, about madness and folly. How appropriate for me.
Yeah, okay. I thought you might want to think about where you're going in life.
I can't wait for the rest.
1989 film, Do the Right Thing.
Okay, now hang on. 40th anniversary. What's the...
Oh, you don't know?
No.
Mark, it's Rubies.
Oh, Rubies. Of course.
Of course. And you know the link to Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing. Rubies. It helped me out again.
Yeah, there was an actress in the film Do the Right Thing called Ruby Dee.
Oh, well, there you go.
One of the main characters in this. The reason I've got you this is to check whether you've been listening to me at different in past episodes of the show. I can't remember exactly which one, but on a number of occasions, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this film from director Spike Lee that was out in the late 80s that was set in New York City, and it's this excellent melting pot of a movie that shows how racial relations and tensions can, if they're allowed to heat up, will just explode and boil over if you don't choose to simmer them down. Do you remember me talking about that film, Mark?
Of course I do. Spike Lee is one of my favorite composers.
So I thought I should give that to you just to check that you've listened to me across these 50 episodes and for the 50 that are still to come. 3.
Okay, so 30th anniversary is...
Pearl.
Oh, you shouldn't have. Okay, really?
This one took me a little bit of effort to do because I didn't want to
really?
Just go...
Really? Like, the others didn't? Like, yeah. You're looking for Ruby in a film?
Okay, sure. That did take a little bit of searching. But Pearl did because I didn't just want to go for the obvious, like, Girl with the Pearl Earring. I presume you'd seen that.
Sure.
And that's, what's the Pirates of the Caribbean movie?
The Curse of the Black Pearl?
Yeah. Come on, that's just obvious, right?
Yeah, too obvious. I would have enjoyed it.
I know you would have.
don't go with that. The best presents are ones that don't so much actually please the person as put them in a catatonic state.
As please the person that handed it to you.
I am so shocked you now that you will probably never recover. That's the sort of present we're aiming for.
For my choice number three, along the theme of Pearl, I've gone with This Boy's Life from 1993 that stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro because there's a character in that film called Pearl and she's played by Eliza Dushku of Buffy and what's the other show she was in? Dollhouse fame.
I honestly have not... Now, I'm surprised because there's a film with Leonardo DiCaprio and...
Robert De Niro,
and I have not seen this film.
No, I haven't either. So the point of my gift to you is because I haven't seen it either. I just want to borrow it.
Well, why don't we just come over Saturday night?
There's a bit of DiCaprio fever going on since he took home the Best Actor Oscar the other week. And this is a film I think a lot of people wouldn't have seen from very early in his career. You should go back and watch the trailer. He just looks like a young boy. But it's set in the 50s. He's playing a rebellious teenager. And Robert De Niro is his stepfather that comes in who looks very kind of nice as pie. But unfortunately, as the film goes along... becomes like an abusive tyrant to the character that Leonardo DiCaprio is playing. So, choice number three, This Boy's Life, just because it's got a character called Pearl in it.
Because you want to borrow it off me.
I do.
Okay. 2. Now, the 20th anniversary, which is, I probably should know we're approaching it in our family, so what is it?
Yeah, you should know this. It's China. So you don't have to fork out for gold or
no,
rubies.
No, you just go for a trip.
That's fine, China. Have you seen Chinatown from 1974?
Oh, yeah. You got me a copy of Chinatown. That's fantastic.
Yeah, have you seen it?
Yeah, it's a brilliant film.
I was hoping to stump you on that, but that's the main reason I got it is because... Pretty much, if you consider yourself a avid movie watcher, a cinephile of any description, you should see Chinatown. It's a terrific example of a modern retelling of old school movie making. So you basically get film noir. It's set back in the sort of 20s, 30s in LA, and Jack Nicholson is playing a gumshoe detective, a guy who's on a really weird case that's got to do with water being stolen.
But as
the movie goes along, it gets increasingly odd and disturbing as some revelations come to light.
This is a fantastic gift. In all honesty, if you liked LA Story, this is the grandfather of that.
Oh, LA Confidential.
LA Confidential, sorry.
Not to be confused with LA Story with Steve Martin.
Which was a fantastic
film. Which was
too.
A good movie, okay. not so closely aligned with Chinatown.
No.
So, yeah, if you want film noir well packaged, you should check out Chinatown. So that's my number two gift for you, Mark. But coming in at number one.
Now, the 10th anniversary, most people should know, so I'm going to let you tell them what
they
it is.
They should, and really, like, it's not terribly inspiring. Tin or aluminium. Because I couldn't find something made of tin. It's an aluminium can for you now.
Is it because I don't think people do much in the way of tin anymore? I don't think people make tin things.
No, so, but they did back in the day, especially in 1958, as one year that did it, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. That is my number one choice on my top five gifts to give to you, Mark. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Hey! Actually, it is one of those ones that's on the must-watch list at some page.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people that would have heard the title may not have seen this film version of it. It starred Paul Newman, Elizabeth Taylor, and Burl Ives, based on a Tennessee Williams play. And it's talk about a melting pot movie. I've given you a few of those. So it's similar to Do the Right Thing. You're trapped in this situation with a bunch of people that have these very these relationships full of friction and tension and secrets and unrealized dreams.
Oh,
and
like 10 Cloverfield Lane.
That's what's going on in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, except for Paul Newman is playing. They're not above. They're not underground. They're above ground.
Nice variation.
Paul Newman is playing like this faded high school star hero whose like life hasn't worked out how he wanted it to.
Actually, this is starting to sound like 10 Cloverfield Lane.
And Elizabeth Taylor is playing his wife, who their relationship is terrible, and you start understanding why longer the film goes along. The reason I picked it, not because I'm suggesting that your marriage is due for a kind of checkup, but it's a good reminder that for anyone married, as far as a good remedy for marital struggles, is to address issues before personal crises rear their head, before you get into the situations that you see on screen and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Don't let that occur. Instead, talk it out or hug it out or do whatever you can to foster your relationship. So I think it's a little bit of a negative reminder. It's a great reminder of why you should look after your marriage relationship.
Or any relationship that matters. No relationship, particularly the one between us and God, benefits from running away from it.
I feel all the time like a cat on a hot tin roof.
Then jump off the roof, Maggie, jump off it.
The Tennessee Williams Pulitzer Prize winning play unfolds with a shocking impact and uncompromising realism that makes its author the most talked about dramatist of our day. Elizabeth Taylor is Maggie the Cat, a girl too hungry for love to care how she goes about getting it.
I don't mind making a fool of myself over you.
Well, I mind. I feel embarrassed for you.
Feel embarrassed? But I can't live on this way.
Now, you agreed to accept that condition.
I know I did, but I can't. I can't.
Oh, Ben. Thank you. You shouldn't
have,
seriously.
You're about to say I shouldn't have, but you know I should have, because you actually wanted some of those movies.
Well, there's at least one which you want to borrow off.
It works out for me too. Okay. Happy episode 50 to you.
And if you'd like to check out the other 49 episodes of The Big Picture, or for that matter, articles and videos and things that we've done, you can go over to thebigpicturewebsite.com. That's thebigpicturewebsite.com. So it's the same. You've got to put website in the URL, people.
You do. Well, that brings us to the end of our special anniversary episode 50 edition. But looking ahead to next week, Mark.
51, when we turn 51 and do that. The whole thing again. Okay. The Big Picture journeys to Zootopia, the animated destination that's so hot right now.
Is Supernatural Spookfest The Witch the most Christian movie you'll see this year?
Or will that title go to Miracles from Heaven? Find out next week.
I will still be, even when we're 51, I'm going to be Ben McKechnie.
I'll remain Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.